Good morning. I think it's easier if I say, I'm a salesperson, or I'm an engineer, or any number of other professions that give people a succinct, or at least a sufficient idea of what someone can do as a career. But the word peacemaker is not so easy. Dan and I have done 4 different peacemaking assignments. My first was 2 years in Fresno, California, with the Victim Offender Reconciliation Ministries, where I worked with juvenile delinquents. Dan worked in Poland and then Northern Ireland with youth in divided communities. And then together we served in Africa. We lived in Northern Uganda for 3 years, working with the Acholi Religious Leaders Peace Initiative, and then 3 more years in Chad with the Association for Nonviolence. As peacemakers, between Dan and I, to describe what we do, we've said things like, I've taught English, I've directed a peace choir, I've supported war orphans, I've designed and installed solar panel systems, I've taken dictation for a bishop, I've driven mothers to comfort families attacked by rebels, I've organized a library, I've taught typing. So, what is peacemaking? In a narrow sense, it is doing direct mediation between conflicting groups or individuals and teaching others to do the same. Every culture is going to do this a little differently, so hopefully a good mediator and trainer is taking into account the culture and the setting. In Uganda, I observed that the processes I had learned in the U.S. were not going to work. I had developed some alternatives with my local colleagues to try there. Here, a mediator listens to both sides and is given the authority to make a recommendation for a resolution or leads the conflicting parties to a resolution themselves. But in Kitgum, many sides are consulted and involved in a resolution, and rarely do the individuals who are most directly affected have more say than anyone else. For example, one common situation that kept coming up, one that can divide a community and lead to cyclical violence, is when a young woman does not want to marry the man her father has picked out for her. She must involve her uncles, maybe her aunts, as mediators. And at a meeting, it is the extended family, the church members, and even the future husband's family that all come together to discuss a resolution. While this makes it much more complicated, it gets deeper into the heart of what peacemaking is all about, shalom. As churchgoers, many of us have probably heard that word, shalom, from the Bible, and may know that it means a whole peace, a peace that includes all. Mediators in the U.S. often talk in terms such as meeting in the middle or making things right if there's been something done wrong. This is a good start, but the meaning of shalom, the word in the Bible for reconciliation, has a meaning based on context. Many words are used to translate the actual word shalom in the Bible. Salvation, justice, peace, health, well-being, security, wholeness, integrity, abundance, intactness, honesty, prosperity, right relationships, harmony, blamelessness, just to name some of the different words. So maybe that explains peace work as Dan and I see it and why it encompasses such a variety of work for us. One way I describe being a peacemaker is to say I'm a creative problem solver. Something is missing or broken or needs another set of helping hands. What can I do? In our second African service in Chad, I spent a significant amount of time working to organize a library. This began when I first walked into it, a room holding the largest collection of books outside of the capital city, which was a day's drive away. Schools don't have textbooks, so students, if they want to do their homework, have to come to this library every day to borrow books. Students stand in long lines, hundreds of them, outside the library collection room and request the book they want, and the librarian finds it from one of the many hundreds of books carefully stacked on tables while empty shelves line the room. I especially love solutions that don't need any money. So I explained we could put the books on the shelves and let the students see the books. Simple, but involved. One important part of this process actually meant creating a Dewey Decimal Number for Africans that wrote fiction in French. I believe Dewey would have done this himself if he had lived in these times, and so I advocated that we do that. The French librarian in the capital, where my colleagues did their librarian training, was actually very upset by this suggestion. She asked me to leave the room. But our library was for Africans, not for the French, not for her. And I kept telling the librarian that I was working with in Mundu, and so this resulted in all of the fiction written by Africans being together under their own number and easy to see in our humble library. And why is this peacemaking? Chad is a very poor country. It's the one right below Libya, next to Sudan. It's in the top five of the most corrupt nations in the world. In general, young people in Chad have a bleak future, very high unemployment, a very immoral government. Students were attacked with machine guns on school grounds by the army more than once while we lived there. Recent civil war, ongoing violence, continues to threaten away investors for the country. These students work hard in school, desperately wanting to believe something bigger than what they see every day. And so I will never forget the look on their faces when they were actually able to walk into a library and then find the shelves of African-authored books. Africans write books? And I'd say, and here is the shelf of Chadian books. Books printed, authored, published. And their eyes would pop out, and they'd say, Chadians write books? And you see a whole world open up to them in that moment. So shalom is as much about process as it is about outcome. Shalom is about the means as well as the end. In other words, the journey, how you get there, can be even more important than the destination. Teachers know this, right? And a large part of what we've done in Africa as peacemakers is now called capacity building. In the above example of the library, I was also training Chadians how to build a database, how to work as a team, how to develop and manage a budget and buy materials, and any number of other practical things. Less concrete, but equally important, was the faith I put in the students. Allowing them into the library and to touch the books was a big step for my colleagues. Even bigger was my standing up to the colonial power, the French librarian who didn't approve of how we organized our French library. Modeling these values was empowering our partner, another important aspect of peacemaking. Well, in January, we begin our next assignment in South Africa. Our partner, the Southern African Development and Reconstruction Agency, is in the Cape Town area. It's smaller than our previous partners, but has a mighty vision. Working with Pastor Oscar Sawali, we will be doing training ourselves in schools, community centers, and with pastors and church communities. And we've been told that how we do this, how we follow Oscar's leadership and model power-sharing dynamics as the only white people in an office of black people is going to be as important as other aspects of the work itself. Oscar has a tremendous vision for the reconstruction that needs to happen in his beloved country. The effects of apartheid are still felt in every realm, and much work is needed to build a functioning, democratic, equal society. Even with all the work that has been done, reconciliation is a struggle because restitution is so difficult. I've already heard this simple illustration several times. The white man has come to the table and apologized to the black man for taking his bicycle. And then he rides away from the meeting on that bicycle. I would go so far as to say there's even a new generation of disenfranchised Afrikaner youth who might even deny ever taking anybody's bicycle. Preparing for our upcoming work in South Africa, I've read several good books, and one is a fascinating book by Dr. Jonathan Jansen, the first Black South African dean of the University of Pretoria, the center of traditional Afrikaners institutions. Titled Knowledge in the Blood, Confronting Race in the Apartheid Past, it is a dense and academic book on the different knowledges that we carry around with us, such as internal knowledge, historic, embedded. As he says, quote, the problems with embedded knowledge is it's not there. It's in the claims, the silences, and assumptions about knowledge concealed in the belief and value systems of those who teach and learn. Changing school curriculum without changing the curriculum makers is especially difficult under conditions of a sudden and radical social transformation. For the ordinary white South African, and Afrikaners in particular, the transition remains a traumatic experience. To quote a psychotherapist's perspective, South Africa is an intensely anxious society, living with many unresolved fears and collective fantasies, much repressed anger, guilt, and shame. Many Black-white relationships are unstable and ambivalent. The necessary collective healing will have to go far beyond the superficial political processes of reconciliation, reparation, and truth-seeking about the past, as urgent as those are. Today is Christ the King Sunday, the critical culmination of the church year before Advent. As a Mennonite, my embedded knowledge about what Christ the King means is probably different from yours. Mennonites really aren't into kings. Mennonites are a low church Protestant denomination. And in the Reformation, they distanced themselves from anything that looked Catholic. No feast days, candles, robes, incense, pictures, statues, no stained glass, no organs, no instruments. For centuries, Mennonites and other Anabaptists were persecuted for their belief in adult baptism and later for their pacifism. And they were refugees as they moved from state to state around the world, trying to find a place where they could live simply and avoid being forced to join the military. This history is part of why Mennonites generally avoid politics and traditionally live in closed farming societies. Church leadership is much more linear than other denominations. We don't have a big hierarchy. And any sermons I remember hearing on Christ as King were very quick to use the phrase Christ as servant King. Mennonites believe that the kingdom is now, and we are here to imitate Christ, and we are not working for rewards in heaven as much as living our faith as fully as possible now, as servants to each other. My father's generation, the first to leave the farm, is full of nurses, teachers, and nursing home attendants. Christ as servant leader fits our theology well. It fits our embedded knowledge well. And I could obviously tie that in to the shalom work that our family plans to do in South Africa. But we are Mennonites going to South Africa, where from my rudimentary understandings, I've observed two dueling theologies that have coexisted there exclusively. One is from the churches of the Afrikaner and the English, the God of those who have had power, the God of the prosperity gospel. Like pre-World War II Germany, the word from the pulpit supported division and separation from the other and justified the oppression of others. God blessed the Afrikaner, blessed those who were good stewards in their land of Eden. Christ the King protected and supported them when the rest of the world judged and turned on them. The other church has been the majority church, the churches of Black South Africa, where various versions of liberation theology have been proclaimed. This is the God of justice, of the wrongfully imprisoned Joseph, the God of patient Job, who was eventually rewarded for his long suffering. Christ the King is the Jesus that identifies with the oppressed and provided comfort for those in the long fight against apartheid. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord, and sometimes God's vengeance can be helped a little from those on earth. What do we do with these two theologies? They cannot continue to coexist if South Africa is going to rebuild itself. God must be reimagined. Kingship has to be redefined. This is one reason South Africans have invited Mennonites to come and work with them. They want to learn more about our nonviolent God. But more importantly, the new South Africa had a first leader that said, and I quote Mandela here, "We were expected to destroy one another and ourselves collectively in the worst racial conflagration. Instead, we as a people chose the path of negotiation. Instead of hatred and revenge, we choose reconciliation and nation building. We understood that oppression dehumanizes the oppressor as it hurts the oppressed. We had to refuse that our long sacrifice should make a stone of our hearts." Going back to Dr. Jansen's book, using historical inquiry on post-World War II Germany, he makes several observations, such as that even when confronted with horrific knowledge, perpetrators and beneficiaries of evil systems do not change. In South Africa, he sees, and I quote from his school, "white students do not rush in confessing guilt or acknowledging racism, nor do white parents suddenly own up to years of privilege at the expense of Black citizens. Even when such compulsion is felt, it is extremely difficult for human beings to unburden themselves in private or public spaces. Guilt and shame are more common responses." Another of his observations is that once the link between the suffering of victims and perpetrators was established in post-World War II Germany, the capacity for the perpetrators to change rose, not simply recognizing that both sides suffered, but that they were inextricably intertwined. And that reminds us of the inspiring illustration that Reverend Danny gave a couple of months ago. I think you remember this, about the school principal that put the two fighting kids on a bench. It was outside her office, right? Yeah, on a couch, ooh, even better. And says they cannot leave until they could agree on the same story. As a peacemaker, I recognize this is an important truth. It is when our stories converge, when we truly empathize with those different than us, that leads to compassion and change. I'm seeing more these days about the value of one story, and I think this is something we could learn from as we struggle ourselves with our own country's historical and ongoing story about racism here in the U.S. Our stories have not come together, and many here are hurting. But Dr. Jansen's final observation in his book is that insisting on one great unifying story cannot be a prerequisite for nation building in South Africa. Bringing everyone into common knowledge is going to be a very long process. He concludes his book with the acknowledgement of brokenness, a word we know well in the church. Brokenness, the realization of imperfection, the spiritual state of recognizing one's humanness before the forgiving and loving power of God. But brokenness is more. It is the profound outward acknowledgement of inward struggle done in such a way as to invite communion with other people and with the divine. Brokenness compels dialogue. And now we are back to the beginning. Shalom, the process being the way to peace, not just an end in itself. Dan and I are eager to learn more about how this works in the South African context and to find the lessons that apply to us personally in our own brokenness and our own embedded knowledge in the blood. I'm going to end with a sermon snippet from a pastor that has been a partner with Mennonite Mission Network for a long time, Olas Kosana, as we reflect on Christ the King. Jesus is a universal Jesus. He is the one to whom all knees must bow and all tongues confess. That's why it's possible for me, as a Black person, to step out of my church, having experienced Jesus as one who identifies with my brokenness, and walk into Leon Oosthuizen's church with white people and worship the same Jesus. There, I tap into the universal Jesus who loves everybody, who welcomes everybody, who died for everybody, and I'm comfortable in that environment. I don't ask the question, why do these white people lift their hands to Jesus and then turn around and exploit others? I understand. They need the same Jesus that we need. It's been a process, for sure, but I've learned that an oppressor who looks for Jesus will find him.